Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, as always, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hello, Sir Tim.
How are you, Jason? What's going on?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm feeling a little blue. Oh, see? I kind of played into a joke we can tell later.
Okay. All right.
That's the best kind of podcast.
That is. When you set them up like that,
yeah,
and then knock them down later, it's good. It's good. I'm happy and comforted and in my happy place, because since this week, your review of the third season of Detectorist posted,
yes,
and you've seen the third season of Detectorist,
yes,
we can talk about Detectorist for the third straight week, which we're going to do right now. Let's do it right now. So.
Magnificent.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it's great. I would say... Not on Twitter that often, but when I'm on there, I see responses. I was on there today and saw a lot of people talking about how happy they were for those to see that review, or they got swayed to it for the first time. And I think that's the kind of thing that makes you and I happy.
Getting
new viewers.
That's the best. That's the best. In fact, we have a letter about that later. And I, not to spoil the answer to that letter, but isn't it the best when you find something great and you share it with people? Because you know that they're going to, it's going to be a pleasant experience for all. It's a really nice feeling when you pass something like that on, and people, especially when it's good enough that people come back to you and are like, thank you, that was so great, I love that so much. And that's how I feel when you mentioned Detectorist. I was like, oh, that sounds really like up my alley, I should watch that sometime. And then I watched it and was like, why did I wait this long to watch it? It's so great. So the third series, it's as good as the others, I think, and I think it leaves it in a nice place. And I absolutely want them to come back and do a Christmas special in a few years, even though they have said, oh no, this is it, we're not going to do anymore. I don't care. I'm holding out hope that we'll get a 2 years, 3 years, 5 years out, we'll get a Christmas special out of them. British TV loves doing Christmas specials.
I think we will get that. Actually, I'm with you. I believe that. It's such an accomplishment, and I think that Mackenzie Crook will, and Toby Jones will look back later, but Crook, especially since he's running the show, will look back and say, you know what, this was a great moment in my life as a TV creator and a TV star and whatever. This was a special thing, and the more I have space from it, the more I realize like how lucky we were to nail it. So let's add on to it with this little loving Christmas special. Yeah,
let's check in with, I mean, when you do something like that, you get to go back and see your people that you worked with on that show a few years ago, who you maybe haven't seen them all in a while, and certainly not all together. And you get to, because this show is such a slice of life in these characters. These are quirky, regular people in a regular little town in England. And that's the thing that has always struck me about that show, is you could just drop in on any point in their life and see sort of like what they're dealing with at that moment. So it seems like the perfect kind of show to revisit a few years down the line and just sort of see, you know, they're all much the same, and yet some things have changed. And you know, we've got a couple of characters who are parents, and they bought a house, a real fixer upper of a house. Mm-hmm. And there's the did they ultimately find gold in the field after all, after 3 years? I don't know. It's only the magpie knows for sure. But what could that? It's just all. Yeah, so I hope they come back. And it's one of those shows that I immediately thought, I'm just going to watch the whole thing again pretty soon, just from the beginning, because it's so delightful. So I'm glad you liked season
three. It's a pretty easy breeze through, too.
I mean, I think they're all like six or eight episode seasons or something like that. And they're like half hour shows. They're all not...
six, and then the second season has the Christmas special, which is seven,
right?
And as I said in the review, you can the first two are available right now on Netflix. If people don't have Acorn, you can watch all three on Acorn. I think you can actually watch the first two on BritBox, I'm told. I actually don't have BritBox.
Yeah, I think season one and two are available broadly, and then season three is an Acorn exclusive right now.
Right. Yeah, which is good for them. Yeah, they're a good little outfit.
Total, it's 19 30-minute episodes. And if you don't have Acorn, watch the first two on a streaming service you do have, and then you'll be like, I could sign up for an Acorn trial now and watch season three.
Right. Exactly.
So anyway, very happy to talk about that one last time until the inevitable reunion show. Our wishes will make it happen, right? Is that
somewhere
how that
down
works?
The line, we'll be doing a podcast and we're like, there it is, Jason. There yep. it is.
Episode
just announced.
345 of the Old People Talk About Television podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
So you saw, you, it looks like you saw Mosaic, which is coming to HBO mm-hmm. this weekend. This is Steven Soderbergh's weird experiment that in non-linear storytelling that HBO gave him some money to turn it into something linear. What did you try to watch the app and then watch the HBO version? Did you
yes.
give up? That's what you did. You tried to watch the app version mm-hmm. first.
Yeah, and it's not so much giving up as it is. It's just like it's not as interesting. It just seemed to me like a lot of work. Mm. I thought it was interesting at the beginning, but not like, oh, this is revolutionary. It looks like a game that they don't want it to be called a game, but it looks like a game that you scroll through, and then you have all these little side detours of extra benefits
right.
that you don't get in the TV view, and then when you reach the end, you go on it, you follow another character, you have to unlock things, and you get to, it's the maze you get through to tell the story. You don't get like it's not like, I didn't finish it, so I don't know, maybe there are multiple, I don't think there are multiple endings.
No, there's only one story, like there are multiple right. viewpoints, but it's not Rashomon, nor is it like Clue where there's different endings. Like it's all the same ending and the same story. It's just sort of different streams with different viewpoints and revealing different information, but it's all the same stuff.
It was very creative, and I actually liked not getting a lot of the. I think it works against you to see both of them. I think either see one or the other. Although,
agreed.
As I tried to say up in the review, it's like if you just watch the TV review, you're going to see some really weird cuts, which were indebted to the app, and I think that you're also going to say something's off here. Like something looks weird and like flat. And I think that's because a lot of it is structured so that there are more close-ups than usual, so it plays on a phone.
Right.
The video plays on a phone better. You can't have a lot of distance and things like that. So, it's a tight little compact story. Weirdly, it's like there are really exceptional acting performances. Sharon Stone's pretty great in this. It's mm-hmm. really interesting. She's really kind of owning up to. It's like we put women in television and film into this position where they, you know, as we say, women of a certain age have to like live up to this impossible beauty standard. And then they don't get roles when they get older. You know, we've talked about it many times about how, you know, the CW used to have like 36-year-old actresses play moms, you know, and then so it's like everybody is, you know, it's tougher. So, and Sharon Stone, who was a full-on superstar, movie superstar, to go in there and to basically play a woman who feels that she's getting older and needs, she wants to be wanted and needs someone. And for someone younger, she was kind of collecting younger little trophies, which of course builds to a murder mystery. I think she did a great job of that, and the cast was really well done, but I it never moved me as far as I was always aware that something else was missing or going on, or that it came from a different place, or what it was, a creation that was not meant to be watched how I was watching it, and it was a little bit off-putting because of that.
Yeah, it's having read some backstory about this one, I think what struck me in watching it and thinking about how it's structured is it feels like they wanted to be much more ambitious mm-hmm. and like they really wanted to have lots of decision points and lots of extras and things like that. And then it seems like as they were making it, they realized that they were way too ambitious and either it didn't work or they didn't want to put in that much work or it was for some reason. And so what you got in the app, it's something that's really like lightly interactive. They're basically like episode length video streams with
yeah.
a handful of mm-hmm. hyperlinks in them as you go, mm-hmm. most of which are not interesting. There are some video video ones that I watch, but most of them are like, here's a PDF of a document. It's like, I'm watching TV now. I don't care about your PDF of your document. Yeah. And I would have felt differently if it was a whole bunch of little like 5 minute blocks and I was moving around and then I would be like leaning forward and thinking of it as an interactive experience. But the videos are so long that they are essentially TV episodes. And I think that's where it comes apart. It's like, you either need to make this, like interactive or not interactive, and not this kind of like fake interactive. And because the blocks are so long too, you get in that point where you go to the end and it says, how do you want to follow the story? Your decisions are kind of weird. Like, I mean, first off, they're not very clear about what the next things are.
I don't want to follow the story.
Right? It's like, there's this person with an obscure title or this thing with an obscure title. You're like, I don't even know what that means. And then it doesn't really follow the story, right? Often it will back up and then come back forward again. So again, I feel like that would have been solved if everything was in little blocks and you were moving around. But for some reason, maybe because it didn't work, they're like, oh no, we can't do that. We're gonna change our approach. And as a result, the app is kind of neither fish nor fowl.
Yeah.
Which is why on one level, I mean, I watched the whole thing and I was entertained by it. I kind of wish it was even less interactive and they had sort of like just had me walk through it. Or maybe the linear version I would have preferred. I don't know. But it's like once you are taking me that far out of a kind of gaming, leaning forward kind of experience and making me just sit there and watch 40 minutes of video with like two interruptions, optional interruptions, at that point, I'm just watching a TV show. Like, it's not an interactive experience, really.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that there's probably a part of it where I think people who are watching the HBO version, and they probably should. Why not? I mean, give it a shot. See if it hooks you. I think it's what, six episodes?
Yeah, and I mean, we talk about the form and not the story, but I mean, it's a murder mystery essentially with some twists and turns, and you get a lot of different suspects. And the interactive version, at least, because you're so tightly focused on individual characters, that's one of the ways that it obscures the mystery and the suspects, is that you follow one track and you're like, oh boy, this is really bad, and then you follow another track and you say, oh boy, this is really bad, right? And then you kind of like figure out all the suspects in a somewhat unique kind of way of doing that. And that's, I mean, there's good, you're right, Sharon Stone is good. Her character is you see why people love her, and you also see why she's actually in reality a very difficult person, which I think is a nuanced character and a good performance, that you end up realizing she's kind of awful, but you can see the positive side of her too. I think Garrett Hedlund is good. I think several of the performances in it are really good too. So I wonder how we would take it if it wasn't sold to us as a narrative experiment and it was a little mystery from Steven Soderbergh with Sharon Stone.
Yeah, I think that would have been better. I'm not sure if you, that's the hard part of this series. I think that if it was just Mosaic, the HBO series, people would watch it. I don't think Steven Soderbergh would have made it. He would have been like, I got 10,000 things I'm doing. As I note, he's super creative.
No, he wanted a challenge.
Restless.
And this was the challenge he gave himself. Also, there is that moment where, and I think I mentioned this when I talked about it a few weeks ago when my wife and I watched it, where in one of the streams, Beau Bridges just kind of walks in for a couple minutes and then walks out again. Mm-hmm. And it's fine, except as a trained viewer, you watch that and it kind of blows the interactivity of the mystery, because you're like, there's no way that they got Beau Bridges to just be this random character in one scene, and obviously he's going to be important in some other thread of this story, which he is. And that's the downside of casting somebody who's fairly well known, is that you're just like, nope, that's important because the guy is important. But also Michael Cerveris, who people might not know, he was the bald, weird observer guy on Fringe for a bunch of years. And he's a Tony winning actor. He's much more established as a Broadway actor, but he's in this, and I think good too, in a different kind of role for him. So there's good stuff in there. But yeah, you're right, I think Soderbergh was entirely motivated by, what if we do something super weird and interactive? And then at some point it seems to have gone off the rails a little bit, and so we get something that's kind of in between.
Yeah, fine. It's almost like you needed a, because it's like a visionary director makes a like a, an app slash game. They don't want to call it a game, you know, but then doesn't really have the gaming skills to make it as interesting as in 2017, 2018 that people would need it to be. And so then you gamer or interactive, it's not as good, like you said. And then it's like, well, okay. So did Soderbergh then just make the best half hour? I mean, you know, 6-part limited series. He made a good one, but it's not the best one ever. So I think it just kind of comes up short everywhere. And I worry that undersells how good the performances are. That's all I'll say.
All right. I think that's fair. Okay. So we have one show that is coming out. You're doing a review of it, but it's not up yet, which is Blue Planet 2. What can you tell me about it?
Oh yeah, feeling blue. Yeah, starts tomorrow. I would tell everybody, I you know, if you've seen the Planet Earth 2, well, 1 and 2 obviously, but Planet Earth 2 was in my top 10. It came out in February of 2017. If you've already seen that, then there's really, I don't have to sell Blue Planet to you, because you probably already watched Blue Planet, the original one, like almost a decade ago, 9 years, something like that. So you don't need me to sell you on Blue Planet 2. Those people who have not, these are the benchmark nature documentaries, and you just can't get any better. You'll just I was trying to do my review, and it's a really hard review to write, because you can't oversell it. Because there's so much better stuff that you're going to see than I could explain to you. And there's not enough hyperbole that can do it justice. So everything kind of, you know, I feel like mosaic here. I feel like the whole thing's falling short. But, like, you just need to watch it. It's just amazing. It's just got to get people to sit in front of it, and their minds will be blown. I mean, this will be totally blown. It is a beautiful viewing experience. It's stunning to look at. Not just because they went places that people don't normally go with cameras, underwater in an ocean and all the oceans, but with the technology, and you're able to go on some submersibles in areas that no one's ever gone before. They are now able to photograph light that they could never get before. And so there's these plankton and other fish giving off these amazing blue light. It's coming out blue on your TV. Whether it's blue in real life, I don't know, but it's beautiful to look at. It's stunning. And then there's, of course, those mini drop dead moments, you know, remember in Planet Earth 2, where there were the snakes chasing down, you know, the ones that got, those went viral. I think the one that's going to go viral from Blue Planet is astonishing. There's apparently how it was said. The backstory is as good as the visual. Apparently, what fishermen used to say, so it was an old fisherman's tale, that there was a fish in this area that would leap out of the water and snag birds out of the air. And people were like, yeah, that's never happened. There was no video evidence and no photos of it. And so the Blue Planet people went there, and yeah, they got it. They got it on camera, and they got it a lot of different ways too. It is mind blowing to see a fish that's tracking, it's tracking something, you know, above it, and to leap out of the water and to catch a bird. And I'm, you know, it's, as I noted in my review, that's usually done the other way around. So imagine the bird's surprise, and you know, David Attenborough is talking about it in his laconic and British way. And he says, very calmly says, the level of skill involved here is that you're tracking, you know, altitude, speed, and everything else of trying to get this bird out of the air. And it's just, I don't know, when you see it, it's, I don't know if anybody has ever had their jaw fall open in real life and not a cartoon, but this is pretty close.
Awesome. I'll check it out. I feel like we're in kind of a golden age for these you know, and it's all like improved by, if you've got like a 4K TV streaming on Netflix, you've got like a big screen, you just can, these nature documentaries, the technology to show them to you in your home on a big screen and have them be beautiful, the technology to shoot them in places where, in ways you haven't seen before, because we have little cameras and we have drones and we have, you know, little mini subs and all sorts of little things that can do stuff that we can see things we've never seen before from a perspective we haven't seen before. It's like a great time to be a person who likes to watch nature documentaries, I think.
Yeah, and I think the hard part of writing about them is that, sure, a fish that flies out of the water and eats a bird is pretty amazing, and unseen creatures, the creatures that have never been seen before that look like sci-fi creatures are almost hard to explain. They look like they were drawn up I said that they were drawn up at Pixar, because there's some things that, like, oh, look at these little cute little, this looks like it's an outtake from, you know, Monsters, Inc. But it's not. It's real life. And so it's hard to bring that to life. But also the thing that I found when I watched it is, yeah, all that stuff is amazing. But the cinematography of something where you are flying over and you're in Antarctica and you're flying over an iceberg and without much sound, and you either have a helicopter or a drone or whatever it is, and this sea of white that's cut with us in the middle by a sea of blue, visually it's awe-inspiring. And that's, what is that? That is probably the least most amazing shot that they use, but they linger on it for a little bit and you're like, oh my God, that is beautiful. That is a beautiful cinematic scene, and they haven't even done anything yet. So that'll tell you how hard it is to do the rest of it, but go watch it. It's on BBC and AMC and all the channels, IFC, WE TV, Sundance TV, all of it's on tomorrow, Saturday at 9, and then every subsequent Saturday at 9, just on BBC America after that.
BBC America, very nice. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what I think is a really interesting piece that you wrote about the evolving role of criticism in the peak and platinum TV era. And this is something that we've talked about, you know, a little bit, grappled with here. And then it's really interesting to see you then sit there and kind of like put it into a column and talk about it. And I got to say, one of the things that really struck me about it is that it reminds me of the same kind of thoughts that I have always gone through in terms of the role of a reviewer of anything, because I review, you know, software and computers and things like that. And it's always been this question. And I think it's interesting to see that the volume of stuff on TV has gotten to the point where you now have to ask the same question that I used to ask myself about, like, software, where you get downloads. Once you got software where everything was downloadable on the internet, there was literally, you know, just huge numbers, hundreds, thousands, millions of different pieces of software that were available. And the question you ask yourself is, what is the best role for me to serve? Is the best role for me to serve to review a random sample? No. Is the best role for me to serve to find something that nobody's ever heard of that's bad and kick it in public? No, that doesn't do anybody, maybe it makes you feel good, but it doesn't do anybody any good. And I feel like this is really what your piece is about, which is what is your time best spent doing? And something we mentioned earlier, which is, and I like that you talked to a couple other critics too. It's like the act of uncovering shows you haven't heard about that are great, to verify whether the highly marketed and well-known things that are coming are good or not. Like, mm-hmm. those seem to both be really the most important things. Not trying to cover everything, and then here's an obscure show that's mediocre or bad. And because, like, who cares? Literally, who cares? If you didn't hear about it, and now you know you don't want to watch it, like, why even cover it?
Yeah, it's I've been kicking this idea around for a while. I think it all came together because I was doing The Detectorist, and you know, not many people either review it, or as we in a small universe, even watch it. And it's such a great show. And a lot of what we do on the here on the podcast, of course, is to try to direct people to shows they've not seen. And, you know, I think I've talked here, and I've certainly talked to people I know that about my list being my year end list of 46 ends up being a list of like 36 shows people haven't seen. You know, and then they want to see it. And this is the feedback I constantly get, you know, because, and I've even said, look, we've long past gone where somebody could say, hey, you're a TV critic. What are your favorite shows on TV? I'm like, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I always tell people, well, my list this year was 46. Last year it was 38 or something. You know, it's just, there's so many great shows. So trying to find our role in the platinum age with so much great stuff, and then too much great stuff, and then you know, how do we? Because you made a good point. You talked about how software and reviewing computers, and certainly software that came that was easily downloadable, made things overwhelming. Well, obviously, people in the music and the book world have faced this before. Movie critics and TV critics are facing it, but we're probably the last one, I guess. The TV critics, but it's such an accelerated pace in the last 3 or 4 years that it's still a big unsolved issue amongst us. I think nobody has like a definitive plan. So yeah, I mean, to sort of see two other people, respected critics, talking about how they don't want to really review bad or boring television anymore, when it's so obvious that it's bad. And they would rather spend time, you know, almost doing a public service announcement where you're putting stuff out like Detectorist and Back and all these other ones that made my list. So I got into that. And of course, you know, the downside is no one wants to just write positive things. But as Alan Sepinwall, is one of the people I quoted, is saying, is that like, if you're tracking series that are supposed to be good, or they're coming, the pedigree from the network or the channel, or the streaming service is so good that your expectations are higher and they don't meet them, then you definitely need to talk about how that failed.
Yeah.
And there's your negative review. Do we have to do negative reviews of every single broadcast show? No, we don't have to. Or just bad. Look, there's plenty of bad, mediocre stuff on Netflix and other cable channels. I just feel like at some point, you know, it's not good. Or you watch the first episode and you're like, oh, this again. And I personally do not want to waste my time on that. I would rather seek out really great stuff. And, you know, as the other side of it, as Alan said, be there when you're hoping something was good and it turned out not to be, or it's just creatively interesting to write about it, like Mosaic in some way.
Right, right, because there's something different to say about it. And this mm-hmm. is also not to say, like, you want to have, like, there's not going to be, like, critic groupthink, because all of you are very independent types, and you're gonna like different shows, and so different critics are going to champion different stuff, and that's great. Like, that's how it's supposed to work. But there is this thing about, like, just kicking somebody when they're down, that I always thought from my own life as a reviewer, is like, if it's a thing nobody's ever heard of and it's terrible, why are you wasting your time? Why are you wasting anyone's time on it? It's like that, because there is a service journalism component that is a huge part. I know a lot of people don't think about it as service journalism, but this is what it is the job of a TV critic, among one of the key jobs of a TV critic, let's say, is to say, hey, these are shows that you don't know about that are great. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. It burned on my brain is that moment where Siskel and Ebert were talking about, like, the most important thing they ever did, which was discovering Hoop Dreams and saying, this is an amazing movie. Everybody should see this movie. And and they helped get that movie seen.
Yeah,
and it's absolutely an amazing documentary. It's incredible. And they're like, finding wonderful movies and spreading the word is like the best thing we could do. And you're right. Sometimes, like, if a Marvel show comes out on Netflix and it's mediocre, yeah, it should get reviewed because people care about the Marvel shows and they want to know. It's so well known that there's, it's worth giving a read. But if there's a random show that pops up on Netflix and it's just boring and not worth anyone's time, why waste your time on it? If nobody is asking and nobody cares, then better spending your time searching for the next show to point out to people and say, I thought this was really great. Here's what it's about. Maybe you'll like it too. Like, that seems to make much more sense to me.
Yeah, and that was the challenge in what we do every day, and for the challenge in writing the piece for me. And I actually loved writing it because it was sort of exercise. And you can't get to all everything. By the end of it, you always feel like you've gone on too long, or you haven't been able to get to an issue that you were interested in. And I think that I tried to get into as much as I could on all these things. And one of them was I tried to point out that, like, I actually have very little interest in reviewing anything that's on network, because it's not built to make great television. I would rather write about great television. They can certainly make great sitcoms, and that's a caveat that I do make. But, you know, I just feel like one of the things I probably could have added in, just as another layer of understanding, is that I think people are pretty good critics themselves of network fare. I think at this point in 2018, if you're watching network television, you enjoy it. And if you're watching network television, it's for a reason. It's like, I want to fold some clothes while I watch this, I like this. It's a murder mystery, and at the 59th minute, it's going to be solved. I don't have to think about it anymore. I'll need to watch 12 more episodes. There is a place for that.
Well, there's probably a TV critic who digs finding the best network procedurals and writes about them. And again, I think one thing we've established on this podcast is, if you're somebody who's looking for someone to analyze all the network shows, network dramas, and tell you what to watch, you're not that guy. And what you're saying is, I'm not that guy, and I can't be that guy, because, you know, you look at those and you're like, yeah, laundry folding is the scenario you can come up with. That's what my wife does, laundry folding. Yeah. I hear you, but I do. There are other critics, right? There are other writers about television who have, everybody has their biases. Like Sepinwall, I always read, like, there's certain genre shows that he would write about, especially back when he had his own blog and he was working at the Star Ledger, and there were nerdy shows that I watched and that he would write about every week, and it was like that was a perfect fit. And there's some of my genre shows that Maureen Ryan writes about, and so I get where she's coming from for those shows. And that's great. And then, you know, the stuff that you watch is very different. And I look at your top 40 list or whatever differently. And I'm still, you know, we're almost done with the Sad Spies now, by the way. So we'll have to move on to another item on the list.
Sad Spies. Are you Patriot. Still calling it that?
Yeah, because I think Patriot's a bad name. I think it's a bad name. I don't think it's a good fit for the show. And I think Sad Spies is a much better name. Because, as my wife would point out, if I say, hey, Patriot, that was a show we watched 5 years ago, she's going to be like, I have no idea what that was about. If I say, Sad Spies is a show we watched 5 years ago, she's like, oh yeah, Sad Spies, right? Like,
oh my God,
it's just, it's a better
funny.
Name. So yeah. Anyway, that's good too. Like having I'd rather have a bunch of really smart, people, educated, watchers of television, good writers, with different perspectives and different takes, ferreting out the things that they want to champion and explaining why that they're good, as well as, yeah, calling out the high profile stuff, good or bad, then I would like putting everybody on a track and saying, like, here come more shows down the assembly line for you to review. Because, you know, I think at this point you can't do that, right? It used to be in your days back at the Chronicle, like, you could count how many original scripted shows there were. They were on the networks, and that was it. And remember, those were the days. And it's just, it's over. You can't do that. You can't play that game anymore.
No, and you know, everybody, I like the idea of everybody having a role. I think one of my personal favorite critics is James Poniewozik at the New York Times, and, you know, formerly of Time. He's just really thoughtful and generous, and he's a smart guy. And I think he's, you know, so like he retweeted my thing and he liked it, and he had a couple comments about parts that he totally didn't agree with, and that's what's really I really like about him, because he's smart and he says, well, this and that, but yeah, like, you know, it's funny, like, even as somebody, I think everybody has a critic that they go for and does something that's special to you. Like, I always say that I'm one of the few people left who actually covers the industry and writes stories like this, or write stories about, like we talked about, Fox clearly being in trouble, and I'll do a Hulu thing. And there's just not that many of us who do that anymore, partly because there's so many shows to review. But yeah, it's
I like,
you know, everybody's got a shtick. You know, not a shtick, but everybody's got a thing where it's good that someone likes network, as you say, even though I don't.
Yeah. And I like what Ponowasik says. I mean, but he's basically saying is, I think something that that you might actually sort of agree about. And I was thinking about this because I was thinking there's I think Wesley Morris wrote a review in the New York Times. It's not even a review, wrote a piece in the New York Times this week about the three billboards outside Ebbing. What is it? Nebraska, Missouri? I forget what state it's
something
in.
Like that. Some movie. Okay, I haven't
the
seen
movie.
Yet.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I haven't seen it either. But what's fascinating about it is he doesn't like the movie. Mm-hmm. And he has some very specific reasons why it bothers him. And it's like, I get what Ponowasik said was basically like, it doesn't necessarily mean you only write reviews of shows you like, but it's only shows that you have something interesting to say. Like,
right.
And I think that's fair enough, right? Like, most of the stuff that you're talking about is stuff where it's like, I can't, what am I supposed to say about this? It is another one of these. If you like those things, you will like this thing. Do I need to write sentences? Can I just put a baseball card kind of for a show that just says, you know, if you like this, then you'll like that. And right. then just walk away. Does there need to even be a review here? And I think there's truth there. Like, what do we want? You know, because the days of being able to cover everything for everyone, that's over. That's been over for a while. And now everybody's just sort of dealing with the fact that they can't do that. So what does everybody do instead?
Right. And I think just lastly on this thing, you talked about like not wanting to pick on something that's just too easy to pick on. I totally feel that. Like, I take no joy in eviscerating a network show. But my standards are, I'm not going to grade it on a curve. I used to try to do that. It's just, you break your back trying to do that. It's not fair to any others. You're in a different business, basically, entirely.
Save your evisceration for Twin Peaks.
Yeah, exactly. That deserves it. So that was easier and disagree. But there's other ones that we can take on. It's no fun to sort of like, when I look at a network show and I have an audible sigh because I've seen it 1,000 times before it's even come out yet. There's no point in me reviewing that. There's literally no point. I would much rather try to go find some obscure British series or just some, you know, like, I don't know how many people are going to review Counterpart because that's coming out in 2 days. But there's probably a number, but I bet there's not going to be more than like a 20 people who reviewed it. That's not a lot of people in the country. And so you can still find shows like that. And again, Sad Spies, not almost nobody reviewed that and no one ended up following through on that. So it's good to be able to have like put your focus someplace else, and especially if you can do good with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And everybody's going to, you know, do their part. Another thing Ponowasik said was maybe it means that it's more criticism and less reviews. And I know that's something you've been with your failure analysis and with your reporter's mm-hmm. notebooks and all these things, you've been definitely pushing toward not everything you do is going to be here is a review of a new TV show. Right. And instead it becomes about like trends and culture and the industry. And that's all part of it, too. And I think that's good. I think that's it goes back to somebody who wrote in, I remember like a few months ago, who said, hey, you know, people don't review every book that comes. You can't read every book that is released. You have to pick and choose.
Pick and, choose. Mm-hmm.
And that's just how it is now.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I totally agree.
Yeah. I mean that, and when I go back to my computery stuff, it's the same thing. Is there was that moment when you realized, oh yeah, like all this software is out there and most people can just download it. And so why are we here again? Like, and the answer was, well, one of the reasons we're here is probably to highlight stuff you've never heard of that you didn't know you need. And that's a different approach than the being, you know, like Lucy and Ethel with a conveyor belt, right?
It's right. Exactly.
But that's where we are now, because there's in everything now, thanks to the expansion of media and the internet and all of that, you know, there's too much of everything. So,
well, getting back to anything that's for me, that's actual criticism, as Ponowasik said, is like, that's, you know, that's what I've been chiming about for years now.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, because like recaps are not criticism. And there was the whole recap era where it was like, television was drowning in that. Yeah. So people still do that. And if you could give me actual criticism in your recap, I would love to see that. But I really have hardly ever seen it.
Yeah, that's I never understood that. That's why I always, and I know people who know all the people who did Television Without Pity. And I know, mm-hmm. I know some of my friends were Television Without Pity recappers. Also, I think Stephen Falk of You're the Worst was a Television Without Pity recapper. I never understood that, because it was like, if I'm going to watch the show, I'll just watch the show. And they were funny, but it was just like a recap. Always preferred like Seppenwall, and we've always joked about how I don't know how he has the time, but back in the day there were so many shows where he would give you five paragraphs that was actually kind of a review take on an episode of a show, and I loved. And when I do post episode podcasts now, we don't, you know, we may walk through the plot, but we're doing it in order to break down our thoughts about what happened, not like just to recap like that. I mean, if it works for you, you know, bless your heart, that's great. But I always wanted a review, not a recap. So that's another problem with TV. We've talked about that one too, that it's unlike a movie, it keeps going.
Yes, going. Exactly.
Oh boy. All right, let's do some letters before we wrap it up. We got some good ones. They're not a lot of them, but they're all I think really good. Donnie and the 206 wrote in, and this is the news. I love it when we don't have to talk about the news because the letters ask us about the news. Tim and Jason, I'm curious to know your thoughts on Amazon's recent cancellations of I Love Dick, One Mississippi, and Jean-Claude Van Johnson. Many critics felt that Amazon should have renewed the first two in order to support shows created by women and LGBT people. While I want shows from diverse creators, I'd argue TV is a business, and shows with few viewers, little buzz, and no awards consideration are always going to be canceled. Hopefully, Amazon replaces them with an equally diverse lineup that attracts more attention, a la Transparent and Mrs. Maisel. What do you think, Donnie and the 206?
Yeah, pretty much along those lines. You know, it's I saw some of that support for One Mississippi, and I wouldn't have this. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there are people who are supporting I Love Dick. I Love Dick was a terrible show, so that show deserved to be canceled. But I don't care who makes
it. So Amazon has a deal with Jill Soloway, so they cancel that and they go on to another deal with them. So
exactly, and not everybody's going to make a great show every time out. That show is not very good. You know, Jean-Claude Van Damme's show, I think I didn't review it. I didn't even watch it. Dan said it was like, well, it was fine for what, like one season. If you wanted to make that joke or you wanted to take that journey, given that there's all these other options, fine, go ahead. But it was never really built to like go on forever. So no surprise there. Then it comes down to, you know, One Mississippi, and is Amazon making a mistake canceling it basically because, you know, it does have a diverse cast. It has, you know, it has tackle. It was a main part, you know, visually for the Me Too campaign, how it tackled the whole thing that was with the thinly veiled look at Louis C.K., et cetera. And it had a heart. It has heart and soul and all those things. That's... You could make an argument that they given that they're so big, they could still afford to do that. I don't know if that's the direction that they're going to be going in the future. I still think they have to make decisions on Patriot, and they could make a decision on Sneaky Pete and all these other ones. I know they're going to get second seasons out of them, but will they last long term? I don't know. I think Amazon is trying to restructure itself and its studio wise to make bigger shows, like more like an HBO thing. That's been the mandate. I don't think you can equate the ousted leaders of that studio who have been tagged as sexually harassing other people and doing all this sexual misconduct for which they have either been fired or people removed and people are fleeing from there. That's kind of like the new regime doesn't need to pay the sins of the other ones. I also think that Amazon was, if you look at its shows, Transparent being the primary example, you know, they've never been like anti-gay or transgender. They've never been like, pro like sexual harassment, you know what I mean? The antics of the person who was the head of the studio were not reflective in their shows, and I don't think you have to keep a show on as penance for something you did or something that the last generation of executives did. I think they're still looking for somebody to run the group. They have a powerful woman in there now who I think is going to be doing really good work. I think that they need to have a woman run the studio, and that this guy currently running it, as a stopgap measure, doesn't get it by default. I would rather see a woman there. For a lot of reasons, not nothing to do with numbers, or is just the fact that there's just not enough women who are in. Give them a chance. I mean, there's so many qualified women executives in the business, but One Mississippi, I have to tell you, it wasn't a show for everybody. It was interesting and it was different, but you'd have a really hard case to make to say that was really compelling. So I don't think that they canceled it like maliciously. And I think if they had metrics, which of course they do, being mm-hmm. Amazon, that said people watch the show, they would keep it. So it's hard, you know, I agree. Maybe the next One Mississippi that's done better or more creatively or more interestingly will come along. You know, people are going to have shows that they like all the time that get canceled.
It may also be, I mean, it's very clear mm-hmm. that the richest man on earth, Jeff Bezos, gave some marching orders to the people at Amazon about where he wanted the video programming to go, which was much broader, more crowd pleasing. And it's also possible that they look at One Mississippi and are like, well, it's fine. And if it really fit with where we're going, we would renew it, but it doesn't fit where we're going. It's a niche show and we're just going to move on. And I could get that too, where it's a situation where it's not just that the numbers demand that it stay or go, but that they're moving in a different direction where they're like, this is not the kind of show we want to make. We want to take that money and make something else. I saw Alan Sepinwall actually muse that he wondered if FX networks might consider picking it up if they could get the streaming rights, just because it is an FX produced, you know, it's a Fox produced mm-hmm. show, and it does actually kind of feel like an FX show in some ways. But then again, I think Alan pointed this out, that I don't think John Landgraf is somebody who enjoys picking up other people's scraps either.
Nope. Yeah, and that's true of a lot. I mean, HBO's never done that. I don't think, I don't think the sloppy seconds approach is really what any creative executive wants to do. A lot of really high quality shows that did not find an audience have been canceled. That's the hard truth about it. Yeah, that's the hard truth. And without knowing the numbers, because Amazon's not going to have the numbers, I think all you have to do is look at Transparent. Now, look, Transparent is a series that has never got great ratings, but it is an awards magnet. It is a compelling story that still gets written about and talked about, but it's kind of an awards magnet. It's still buzzy in its own way, less buzzy than it was in the first two seasons, obviously, but it's still talked about enough. That's a kind of show where when you're looking at the balance sheet and where you're going to go creatively as a network, you say, you know what, it's kind of a loss leader for us if we're going in this other direction. It's still worth it. But and after the second season of a series, like season two of One Mississippi, they know the show's not going to get any more people. And it might have been losing people.
Yeah, they know exactly what the number is.
And so they're like, they know it's not going to work. And if they have one that they're dedicated to, they're not going to have 10 of those. Right. That's all I can say.
Yep, I think that's fair. Kate in the +880 wrote in to say, ooh, you guys mm-hmm. got my hopes up about The Good Place and Planet Earth 2 being available Netflix globally. Alas, they are not on Netflix here in Bangladesh. Still, we get the live Winter Olympics coverage that's almost in our time zone, plus endless HD cricket and badminton. Trading up two question marks, Kate in the +880.
Yes,
I think is this Kate who we met at the yeah. meetup when she was transferring?
Was. Yeah, yes, the international. She's been to 42 countries. Maybe this is her 43rd.
There's no grid for us to check, as far as I know, about what is available where. I'm a little surprised that Netflix. When I hear about like Netflix having a show in a bunch of countries, that it's not in all the countries. I would think that it would be easier for all concerned to just sort of like sell an American show everywhere rest of world, instead of it being like, well, in certain territories and not in others. But who knows? Like, we don't, that's not something, I think it's a miracle we know anything that happens outside the US on this podcast. Like, because yeah, we're not outside the US. I only knew about The Good Place because my daughter was in Mexico watching Mexican Netflix. By the way, Mexican Netflix, they use corn, they use sugar instead of corn syrup. That's the
nice. Yeah. Well done there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to
No, don't even. I don't need that. Your pity. That was so. Anyway, hey, sorry,
I'll tell
Kate.
You what, I would tell you, Kate. I watch badminton any day.
I kind of like cricket. I, as a baseball fan, I kind of like cricket. I don't entirely understand it, but I like the rhythm of it. I've occasionally tuned in cricket during the baseball offseason just as a like reminder, just like as a relaxer.
Really interesting. Yeah.
The 2020 cricket. The fast cricket. Mm-hmm. Is the stuff that I can watch because it's I find that that's way slower than baseball, but it's relaxing. That's the fast cricket. Then there's the test cricket, which is the super slow cricket, and I just can't come back on. Did you know? We're going a little sidebar here.
I clearly did not.
I have a cricket sidebar for you. Did you know that in cricket, even though they do play like a best of five or a best of seven or whatever, they play all seven. They play all five.
Really?
So, like, literally, if it's a best of five and you win the first three, they still play the other two.
Wow.
I don't understand. Maybe this is the American in me, but it's like, we just, once it's done, it's like, well, you win. Like, we don't even need to play the rest of the games. They're like, no, we sold tickets in Australia for this, so we're going to go down there now and play
that is interesting.
Some more meaningless games. And,
nothing
and,
is as... is interesting as you knowing this much about cricket.
Yeah, I have friends.
Cricket.
Yeah, TV cricket. No, I have friends who are cricket fans. That's how I am.
Because I was wondering, like, where is this weird?
I have friends who are cricket fans. That's British and Canadian friends who are cricket fans. So James in the +44, speaking of the UK, wrote in to say, based on last week's show, the similarities between Black Mirror and Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams are very much intentional. Mm-hmm. Netflix, when it outbid Channel 4 for the rights to Black Mirror, Channel 4 came across the Electric Dreams project and commissioned it in Black Mirror's place. It even ran in a similar time slot around the same time of year. So there you go. It was Electric Dreams was sort of the backup after they lost Black Mirror.
That's interesting. And that would put Electric Dreams in such an unfair comparison. Really interesting. Well, that's true.
I heard that from really a couple of people in the UK where they're like, I didn't even bother watch. I watched one and it was like, this isn't Black Mirror. And I thought, this is a funny case where being divorced from that whole story just in the US, you're like, oh, this is another anthology series that's coming on and Black Mirror has already been here and all that. And you take it completely out of the context of it being the new Black Mirror. And maybe it gets judged differently. Interesting.
Absolutely. So, and I whether it was meant to be the replacement and people were bitter that it was left and it was going to Netflix, I will just say this. Yeah, there are really good episodes in that pile of 10.
That's right. It's an anthology. Find a good episode and skip the ones that aren't working for you. Here's one from Rui in the +351. That's Portugal.
Wow.
Yeah, we got a lot of international letters this time.
Nice.
Tim, I have a special problem with Black Mirror. It's supposed to be a complex look at issues related to technology, yet especially in the latest season, Charlie Brooker seems to be sliding into a CSI cyber level of care about technology. It's especially irritating when he does mistakes with absolutely zero need. He has more than 50 minutes per episode. He could lay down the tech path to make things work. And then Rui's letter goes on for a while with details of things that are wrong. And I don't disagree, but it's kind of not the point of Black Mirror, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, that was my instant response is they're fables. They're not, they're looking, they're about us today. They're not about the future. They're not extrapolating about what will reality really be in 20 or 30 years as much as they are about what's at the core of bad behavior. That of our use of technology
today. It's the
human
side of technology. Yeah. Yeah, it's not the technology itself.
Yeah, it's not. I don't think you're ever going to get hard science out of Black Mirror, but it's true. Like he about USS Callister, he was like, "How do the DNA samples turn into people with memories and like the passwords of their cloud accounts?" And the answer is, it doesn't work that way. You're absolutely right, but I like USS Callister anyway, so it doesn't matter to me. I didn't care. It's a show.
That's interesting.
The Scott in the 202 wrote in to say, Tim, I hate you. You've made me laugh at a man recovering from serious brain injuries. I'm on episode 3 of Patriot, watching a character fail miserably at recreating the dance on the piano scene from Big, a character whose brain injuries came at the hands of the protagonist of the show in the first 10 minutes of the first episode, and I'm laughing. You are evil. Although I, of course, feel your top 46 list of 2017 was skewed too far away from broadcast TV, a sore subject. I took your high rating of Patriot to heart and started watching. I also added the A Word, a very different show, no doubt, to my list. There were 13 shows on your list that I watched eagerly and agree with the best TV of last year. I'm enjoying Patriot, even the parts I'm ashamed to admit I'm laughing at. I have high hopes for the A Word since The Leftovers made me such a huge fan of Christopher Eccleston. And then in parentheses, Scott says, hi, Jason, you're right about Travelers. Season 2 is almost as fun as Season 1. Thanks for throwing that in there, Scott.
That's nice.
And well, yeah,
I would tell Scott this. Sad Spies story. Mm-hmm. If you think that storyline, the call back to the head injury suffered by the protagonist, is funny now, you will
just keep watching.
Love that.
Just keep watching.
It's
not the last time you've seen that piano either.
I thought that storyline was brilliant. That, because it was such a small storyline, and it's like a call. It's such a good callback joke that it just gets better as it goes. And I love it.
I mean, he's a spy. He has to get this job in order to be in there so that he can go to Luxembourg and make this, you know, give this money to somebody who's going to take it to Iran. Mm-hmm. It's this complicated spy thing. And the guy he's up against for the job is way better at him, is a better candidate, and is going to get hired. And so he pushes him in front of a bus. I mean, that's the plot of the show. And in the moment, I was like, that's funny and awful and dark, but I see why he did it. This is what the show is going to be. What I wasn't prepared for is the fact that in the next episode, the guy is back and he's got like a whole like puffy thing around his head to protect his head.
Yeah.
And he's got a person who comes with him who's doing his sort of like training to get better and handle his brain injury. And although, yes, I do feel terrible at laughing at that stuff too, and it is just a show and nobody really got hurt. On another level, I kind of really love that is not just done as kind of a shocker moment and then just nobody says anything about it again. Instead, you get to see the guy who is recovering from a traumatic head injury, and it becomes part of the story. And I like that about it. I think that's actually one of the things I approve of in that show, even though, yes, I do feel like a terrible person when I'm laughing at him fall over and fail to dance on the piano doing the song from that scene from Big that they're trying to reenact with Kurtwood Smith.
It's brilliant. That's such a well-realized joke throughout the season. On so many different, that to me is another sign of how good that series is.
Patriot, watch it. You'll feel bad about yourself and you'll feel worse about Tim, but
and you'll
laugh. The sad spies.
Dark.
Our old friend Hannah in the +46 Sweden, of course.
Yes.
Hey guys, I just wanted to thank you for the solid recommendations lately. I'm currently working my way through Tim's Best of 2017 list. This weekend, I have managed to binge the end of the XXXing World, Back, the A Word, and Detectorist. That sounds like a really good weekend, Hannah.
That is a good week.
Good.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is like some shows that, like, you know, you'd love to have any of those shows in your lineup. Those are stellar. All those are stellar.
All right, now we've got a Hobo Eric letter now. It's our friend Hobo.
Wow, he must be riding the rails. We haven't had a letter from him long time.
He's untied his bindle.
Yes.
Back at home in the +44.
Bindle.
Got to do that. Well, only in hobos can you use the bindle reference. And this is actually related to Blue Planet 2. So for people who are thinking of watching it, listen to Hobo Eric. He says, I'm glad I waited to watch Blue Planet 2, which is coming out, as we said, this weekend in the U.S., until it was released here on 4K Blu-ray. It's stunning to watch. If you can wait till March when it's released there, I highly recommend it. Oh, and there are like totally intelligent fish now, so we'll all be fish food soon.
He's right. They can use tools and they can fly.
Yeah, this makes Australia doomed. Surrounded by ocean, and so you just don't go there. Because
I'm never going to visit. Although, you know, I gotta love those. The Australian women are amazing. But
interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, you're going to be down there visiting, looking for Australian women, and you know what's going to happen? A drop bear is going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
While
it'll be perfect,
an intelligent fish flies out of the ocean at the beach and just bites your head off.
Takes my foot off. Yes. Yeah. Or eats the drop bear. One of the two.
Yeah. I think you're spinning this far too positively. I don't want to hear about positive things about Australia. It's too dangerous down there. Okay. Hi, Australia. We love you. That's why we released this episode to you simultaneously worldwide. Matt in the 330 wrote in.
Man, we are so international.
Well, this is just the 330 area code, though, right?
No, but that 330 is totally international.
You think so? Where it is the far-off land of Canton, Ohio. Akron.
Who goes there?
Yeah. Matt says...
I mean, that is...
This is a great question. Iceland. This is our key question for the day, and I think it's a good one, tying in what we were talking about earlier. Matt says, what do you like better? Finding a new show you really like, or deciding that a show is bad enough that you don't have to spend time watching it anymore?
Wow. That is a great question. Wow. Okay. That is a Hall of Fame question.
Yes. It's a Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm sorry, Canton, that I said you were Iceland. I do feel a perverse sense of joy when I put the show in and I'm like, well, never going to watch this again. Because it just seems to tackle, but you know, that's what I'm tackling in the story that we just talked about, the column that I talked about, because I've already made it clear to my bosses that I don't want to do, a lot of, you know, dumb stuff. And so I don't really assign things to me. I pick them. So I tend not to pick them. I do worry sometimes when I don't pick them, Dan has to do them. Although right. He doesn't really have to. Dan could pass too, and then we could farm it out. So that's what I'm kind of hoping will happen. But no, I find more joy in like discovering something like Back or, you know, Detectorist or something like that. It's always better. And, you know, I'm not technically discovering it. I mean, there other people knew about it, Detectorist, before I did. But yeah, like Back was something that it was great. I think you can see that in the people who, I won't have to check the box here, but the people who did, the critics who decided that the week between Christmas and New Year was okay to watch to find out about the end of the effing world, they found a gem and wrote about it, and gleefully. It's always fun to discover stuff like that. So that, I think that's my preference.
Yeah, I definitely would say that. I'm much more happy to just make a discovery, because then, you know what I get? I get to then watch that show and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Whereas that's with a bad show, it's just that momentary, fleeting kind of like, oh, I'm free. But then it's over. It's better to start. I still remember... Like Mr. Robot, I remember watching the first episode of Mr. Robot and just laughing and saying, oh my God, what is this show? This is so great. Like, what a discovery that was. It was great. So that's my vote too. All right. One last letter. Here it is. Okay. This is from Steph.
Is it about cricket?
Looks
is
like
it Stanford stuff?
Looks like it's not. It's Steph R. Yeah. I think that is not Stanford Steph, because I think this is Steph R on Twitter. Okay. I'm going to check, and it's Steph R 214, which leads me to believe maybe that's an area code, but that's in their Twitter handle. Anyway, I don't know that, but Steph R says, TVTM, another horrifying reason not to visit Australia, firebirds. And send in a link to the National Post, which says, here's the headline, Australian birds have weaponized fire. Because what we really need now is something else to make us afraid. Raptors, including the whistling kite, are intentionally spreading grass fires in northern Australia to flush out prey and feast.
I think I'm just punch drunk now. That's genius. I'm never going to Australia.
What is going on, Australia? Now your birds are setting fires
to your lands. It's like a Game of Thrones.
I think you should rethink Australia. I just to Australians, like, maybe people weren't meant to be there. Maybe it turns out people weren't meant to be there because of the poisonous animals and the firebirds.
Yes. I agree. Maybe the lovely Australians could just come visit us.
Thanks, Steph.
Never going there. Ever.
All right. Well, here's how you can reach us. Tweet at us at TVTM. That's a great way. There's a lot of characters on Twitter now, so you could do that. And we'll see it, and then we can read your letter. You can also post on Facebook, facebook.com/TV Talk Machine. We had a couple of Facebook letters in the show today. And, of course, you can email us podcast@TVTalkMachine.com, and you can see all the episodes at theincomparable.com/TVTM, and also in iTunes and your podcast app and anywhere else you can find TV Talk Machine. And that's it. Until next week. Tim, have a great weekend. I'm sure you'll be watching more television because it seems to never end now.
It never ends. I'm going to watch some cricket.
Oh, very nice. It's either that or a bird is going to set fire to everything. So I choose cricket. It's a better way to go. That's what the ashes are. The ashes are of a fire started by a firebird. I think that's where that got the name. Anyway, everybody enjoy the weekend. Enjoy your cricket. And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.